After the chaos that followed the funeral of Freddie Gray, is there a new normal? How do Baltimoreans, from those who live in the neighborhoods where the rioting and vandalism took place, to those who live far from it, feel about city life today? We'll explore that in the next hour of Midday. The Baltimore Sun's restaurant critic, Richard Gorelick, joins us, along with Sarah Meehan, who covers hospitality and tourism for the Baltimore Business Journal, and Heather Harris, a communications professor at Stevenson University. Plus, we'll hear about a new opera composed by a Peabody Conservatory grad student and based on the true story of the execution of a 14-year-old boy in the Jim Crow South. That's Midday after the news. Welcome back to Midday Friday. Dan Rodrigues here. We'll continue to take calls, get your comments about the Freddie Gray case and all that's happened since Freddie Gray's death on April 19th. The news today about the Justice Department announcing the Attorney General of the U.S., Loretta Lynch, announcing that there'll be a Justice Department investigation of the Baltimore City Police Department. I just want to mention that toward the end of this hour today, we have an interesting segment to present that's it's not on the same topic. The topic is a new opera that'll be having its world debut, world premiere here in Baltimore next weekend. This opera presents the true story of George Stinney, a 14-year-old African-American boy who was convicted of murder and executed in 1944, the youngest person executed in the United States. And we'll be meeting the composer of this new opera called Stinney. Later on in the show, she's a graduate student at the Peabody Conservatory, and along with her, one of the singers who performs in the opera and plays George Stinney's father. So we'll have that for you a bit later on. A very interesting story, a tragic story, but now it turned into an opera. It's kind of an amazing thing. In this hour of the show, we'll continue to talk about life here in Baltimore and get your thoughts and reflections on all that's happened here in the last 3 weeks. We're joined in this hour by Heather Harris, professor of business communication at Stevenson University. We asked Heather in because one of the things that Baltimore is dealing with is how to get up and get going again after a week of curfews and all the unrest that really put a damper on city life generally. Heather, nice to have you back on the show with us.
Thank you.
And Sarah Meehan is with us from the Baltimore Business Journal. We're going to talk to Sarah a little bit about some of the things that are going on in the city, particularly when it comes to tourism, convention, and the hotel bookings in downtown. Nice to have you back with us, Sarah.
Yeah, thanks very much.
And my colleague from the Baltimore Sun, the restaurant critic, Richard Gorelick, joining us here just for a couple of minutes to talk about not just the restaurant scene in Baltimore, but sort of like Baltimore life and get his observations about how things are going here in the last week or so. Richard, nice of you to join us.
Good afternoon, and good afternoon, everybody.
Hey. I note here the Maryland Restaurant Association is mobilizing an effort to help city restaurants boost their business after that week of curfews. What have you been hearing from restaurateurs in the city, Richard?
Everything. I've been hearing everything, and I'll put it this way. I feel as though for the past week I've been staring at a Polaroid print waiting for it to develop. I'm still waiting for that picture to develop, and just when things start to clarify themselves, they get blurry. I'll be really interested to hear what goes on the rest of this newscast, and particularly what your callers have to say. But boy, that curfew was rough for so many bars and restaurants. And when we talk about, you know, how recovering from everything that happened in the past couple of weeks, it was specifically the curfew that people are still talking about in the restaurant industry. And the other picture, the other issues of how Baltimoreans are going to react or cope in the long run or even the short term, that is still materializing. But people will give you numbers about how much that curfew cost them.
And I assume a lot of restaurateurs, once we got into the last weekend, after the charges were announced against the police officers. They were among those saying this curfew isn't necessary, it needs to end. Did you hear that?
They were saying that loudly,
yeah,
and vocally and with a great deal of urgency. And then some of those voices would correct themselves a little bit and understand why the curfew was necessary. But there was a lot of frustration, especially toward that last Saturday and Sunday, mm-hmm, when, how sympathetic was it for, if you're a business owner, a small business owner is very sympathetic. And for other people, maybe it seemed like a little bit whiny. I've never been a business owner, but I certainly know how hard it is to run that business. And in that business, it's tight, and the difference between survival and not is,
yep,
not far.
Yeah. I said in the previous hour that I was concerned that it sounds too trivial to even be talking about it when the bigger issues, all of which we've tried to explore here in the last couple of weeks, of poverty, unemployment, the police brutality, use of excessive force by police, far more serious than whether, restaurants are open past 10 o'clock or not. However, this is a city, and that is part of our business. That is part of what makes it the city thrive. People need to work in that industry. Many people are employed in that industry, and it is important. And Baltimore has tied a lot of its economy to tourism. Let's face it. I mean, that's people coming to town, enjoying the Inner Harbor, and going to restaurants.
It's a huge part of the city. And, restaurants weren't invented for the hell of it. Restaurants were invented or came about because people want to be out with each other. People love people. So you can eat at home anytime, but people want to be out, and they want to be around their fellow people. And it's an important industry emotionally for the city and also, of course, financially. So I was not happy to hear those concerns of that industry brushed off as trivia.
Right.
I'm with you on that.
Yeah. One last thing is the timing of all this is interesting. I note the timing of the last riots, 1968, the death of Martin Luther King, the assassination of Dr. King in April. Here we are. This happened in April. And Mother's Day approaching. Also, a big restaurant day, right, Richard?
Is that big for some restaurants. For those restaurants for which Mother's Day is important, you can't underestimate it. And talking to one restaurant manager down in the Inner Harbor, we tend to forget about the Inner Harbor, but boy, they really depend on this month, not the whole summer, this month in particular, with all the graduations, and we're starting wedding season two, and Mother's Day launches the whole thing. This is huge for these restaurants, and they are depending on this month to get them back on even footing. And if not, I'm a terrible prognosticator, but if not, then just ellipse, dot, dot, dot. I'm going to be very eager to hear what some people with hard numbers have to say.
And we'll keep the eye on the Polaroid photograph to see if it comes into focus for you.
Please, if anyone can sort of help me divine it, I'd love that help. But anything anyone's doing right now is worthwhile, I think. And none of us is forgetting. Well, I hope none of us is forgetting what else is happening in the city. I don't think we are.
No, I don't think we are either. I spent a lot of time talking about that. Richard, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye, everybody.
Yep, that's Richard Gorelick, restaurant critic of the Baltimore Sun. Sarah Meehan is here from the Baltimore Business Journal, along with Heather Harris. Sarah, just a quick one here. You had a story about the convention business. Of course, everyone's looking at that and seeing what's going to happen as a result of this in terms of conventions. Did they have cancellations?
They did. They had a couple cancellations, especially in the first week following the riot. There were a couple conventions that pulled out of the convention center, which is a big deal because it affects hotels across the city, those citywide conventions. And plenty of hotels had individual in-house conventions that were canceled as well. I talked to someone over at the Baltimore Marriott Waterfront the other day, and she said that they've had up to 8 conventions pull out of their hotel. So, you multiply that by the rest of the hotels across town. Some of them are seeing, just the short-term impacts. Others are seeing conventions that are pulling out as far out as August. So you know, Tom Noonan of Visit Baltimore, I talked to him earlier this week, and he said that this week things have stabilized. You know, they're starting to see more businesses who are comfortable coming here, bringing their meetings here. But I guess the question sort of remains, what happens for the future business down the road? Those conventions that are still in negotiation in, you know, 2016, 2017, 2018. Tom told me that, you know, they're still looking to come here. They still want to bring their business here, but, you know, there's still the chance that they could back out if there's the perception that there's violence in Baltimore.
Another area of great competition for Baltimore already, trying to get the those meetings in place here. It's interesting that one in August decided not to come.
Right.
Just based on what's happened here in the last week or so. I wonder where the heat for that comes from. It comes from a membership of a group that's coming, or just an individual that says, let's not take the chances here. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here. I'm glad Heather Harris could join us a little bit to talk about just, I haven't had a chance to talk to you much since all of this has happened, and so much has happened so quickly, Heather. Just your sort of observations about the last week or so and where we are today and what you think for the future here.
When I look at the media coverage, then one of the things or one of the images that sticks out in my mind is one, I think it appeared online. I was looking online, and it was a picture of fire in the background and a fireman in silhouette. Very dramatic and very on point if that is the message that you want to share with the rest of the world. When I look at the websites and what people have to say, especially online in the comments section, I came across comments in a major newspaper that caught me a little off guard. I can't say surprised, but it was this individual saying, you know, I think it's time to return them to the plantation. You know.
Oh, you mean racist comments on a newspaper?
A major newspaper.
Comments.
Yeah, after a story. You know,
not surprised.
Time to return them to the plantation. You know, let's get this thing started again. Obviously, they're not capable of having a material life or a life with technology. It's time to go back to the simpler time. Let's all go back together. And, you know, I start with
what, meaning slavery or something? Is that what was suggested?
I can't read the individual's mind.
There's a lot of racist comments on the internet.
Indeed. And I know students are using a lot of social media. And when I spoke to some of the students at our university, Stevenson University, they were very despondent. And they were saying, you know, to be referred to as thugs and animals, we weren't there, we weren't doing this. And it gives the perception that all of us are this way. And they felt that they were not able to effect any real change in terms of what is happening at this current moment. So when I look at the images that appear in media, and when I think about ways to move forward, one of the things we need to do is to look beyond the separateness. When I saw the presentations by the mayor, the governor, state's attorney, the commissioner of police, it was like a group project that I would have for my students. So if the project is Baltimore and they are the group, they were not working cohesively. They were all very separate. So the mayor gave her, the state's attorney gave her perspective, the police commissioner gave his, and the governor gave
his. Well, they do have different roles, right?
They
especially
do have different
the state's
roles.
Attorney from the police, it needs to be distinct.
Yes.
Right? And the mayor from the state's attorney. Right?
And all of that, yeah. I understand. The point is, the project is Baltimore. And so if the project is Baltimore and they all want the same thing for Baltimore, even though they have different roles, as group members have different roles, there's more cooperation required between all of those members of this group that wants the best for Baltimore if we are to move forward.
Are you saying that through all of this, there was no coherent message?
I'm saying there were messages that overlapped, but there was too much separateness in how the messages were presented.
I heard this comments from others, and these people were very appreciative of Marilyn Mosby last Friday for bringing clarity or at least some sort of temporary finality to what's been going on here. That was the perception of her role in this last Friday. What did you think of that? And were you surprised that the charges came so quickly? Most of us were.
Well, I figured something had to be said, whether charges would be brought or not. Something had to be said that would enable people to have a very real perception that the process of justice was in fact moving forward. So whether there were charges brought or not, she had to say something that would allow the population to believe that they were being heard and something would be done.
Heather Harris from Stevenson University, and Sarah Meehan was with us from the Baltimore Business Journal. We'll speak more with Sarah about some of the impacts that she's spotted around town from the recent unrest. And we need to take some calls, so open phone lines this whole hour here of midday, 410-662-8780. And let's take Patrick's call before we move on to our first break. Go right ahead, Patrick. Hi.
Hi, Dan. I'm a regular listener, and I'm struck today by the homogeneity of perspectives being presented. I would like to suggest that perhaps if you took the show out to the neighborhoods, people who reside in the different areas, the different communities, would have a greater opportunity to present their perspectives. And then the sections of Baltimore would get to understand each other better and perhaps, you know, have greater empathy. Because if nothing else, the recent events seem to highlight the gulf that exists. As people find out about what's happening in one community, there's a reaction, extreme reaction, oftentimes, you know, against what is being presented. So I think the media could be a part of the solution in soliciting from the communities, by going to them, what their concerns are to a greater extent than exists now.
I like your idea, Patrick. For the time being, people come to us and sit in the studio with us. And over the last 2 weeks, I must say, a lot of these folks who've been on our show I've met before as a columnist and as a talk show host. But, boy, people have really been passionate about what they have to say about what's going on and thoughtful and pretty kind to each other, too, I think. And we've had people in here from Sandtown, from West Baltimore, and we get phone calls from people in the deep suburbs and exurbs of Baltimore, too, who have an interest in what's going on here. So in that regard, it's been great. But I like Patrick's idea of actually taking the show on the road, maybe setting up a what do you think, Heather?
A few
microphones in Sandtown or over there in Penn North or anywhere.
Well, right? All over the city. This is a Baltimore issue. It's not just a particular neighborhood. And I think it's time, if we want to have real healing, to think of Baltimore as a community. And, you know, if Baltimore were some kind of house and the United States was, you know, the really good neighborhood, what we see downtown by the harbor and those little neighborhoods down there, that's, you know, you need more curb appeal than that. In order to get it, you know, we have to have some real solutions. I think one of the things that we have to look at is the fact that what's happening in Baltimore, what's happening across the nation is simply symptomatic. It is not the cause. Right. So people talk about, well, all of the leadership in Baltimore, they're people of African descent or African Americans. That's not the issue. The fact of the matter is that the institutions that they run were set up, established with racist orientations. And whether or not they're led by an African American, an Asian American, Latino American, a lesbian, a lot of that culture that resulted from and will carry over.
Yeah.
Until we are willing to pull off the Band-Aid. What we need as a nation is really, you know, truth and reconciliation. That is a way to really say, okay, look, these are the issues that cause these symptoms. We are willing to look at them. If Baltimore does that, Baltimore can lead the way. If Baltimore doesn't do that, it's just a matter of time before we're sitting here again talking about another state, another city, another shooting or something else.
Heather Harris from Stevenson University. Dan Roderick's here on the Midday Show. A short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. Let's take another quick call here. Phil in Forest Hill, you're on Midday. Go right ahead. Hi.
Yeah, how you doing? I tell you, there's so much to talk about, it's hard to find a place to start because as I was telling the young lady who answered the phone, I came from both sides of the equation. You know, I live a pretty middle-class, over-middle-class life in Harford County, but I came from the west side of Baltimore City. And I remember when I was in a position to build a house where I live now, I was able to take my youngest son, who was in the second grade, out of a school on the west side, and he was receiving A's and B's. As soon as we moved to Harford County, northwest of Bel Air, when he was put in school, to find out he was a year and a half behind. And what broke my heart was the fact that I had the financial wherewithal to be able to do that for my children. And all of these other families were left behind. And the fact is, if you literally don't have the education to move beyond, you know, middle school or high school into college and don't have the opportunity to raise yourself to the next level, there is always going to be the air of hopelessness. And this is not the reality of most of the people who you've had on your panel, on your show. Not, you know, I'm not criticizing your show, but it's not their reality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they can pontificate about this and that. And the fact is that these people in Sandtown, Winchester, in Pigtown, Penn North, you can go all over the city, east side, over Luzerne Monument. It doesn't matter. When you have subpar schools, you have teachers digging in their pockets trying to, you know, get supplies when we can put all this money downtown and Inner Harbor, Harbor East, and all over the place where there's revenue generated for the city, but it's not disseminated to these kids who need it. And you lose generations that way, and what do you expect?
Thank you very much, Phil. I appreciate your comments.
Yeah, if I can just add, when you think about city schools, and I used to volunteer as part of Achievement Counts, I think it's part of the Maryland Business Roundtable, and I would go to middle schools to encourage students to prepare for college by taking upper-level courses in science, math, et cetera. And when I would go into these classrooms, these students were functionally illiterate. So maybe one student in the class too had the ability to take some of these courses. The parental connection, because you had to get the papers signed by your parents. Their parents are busy, they're working, you know. And I was so overwhelmed one time. I left a school downtown, I won't name it, and I just sat in my car and cried for an hour before I went to teach my own class because of the
age of the students and the lack of
these were middle school students.
School,
and for one, you know, he said, "Well, what is your name?" And I told him my name, and he couldn't even spell it. It's Heather Harris. Yeah. He could not even spell it. And the teachers, some of the teachers were like, "Oh, don't even worry with them. They're not interested." And I would go in and, you know, ask their names and find out what their dreams were, et cetera. But when you have teachers sometimes teaching in the city and their own students are able to go to the schools where they're teaching and they pull their children out, you know there's a problem.
How long ago was that, Heather?
That's about 3 years ago.
Just only
3 years ago, yeah.
Before we move on here, Sarah Meehan had an interesting story. In today's Baltimore Business Journal, the Friday is the print edition out today. And you looked at how other cities kind of recovered from civil unrest like this.
Mm-hmm.
What did you look at?
Yeah, I spoke with the folks down in St. Louis to hear how they handled things after
Ferguson.
They're 10 months removed from that. And I talked to them, and basically their biggest advice was to just be transparent with the visitors who are coming to your town. You know, they lost some long-term business as a result of that unrest, too. They were able to keep a lot of the meetings that were heading there. But they said that the biggest things that they did were just really offer themselves up as servants to all of the groups that were heading their way. Sometimes that meant helping them cancel. Sometimes it meant just providing more information for guests. And that was their biggest recommendation to Baltimore's tourism industry, was just to really put themselves out there and say, you know, we're here to help you however you need.
And say, this happened. We all know it happened. We're not going to deny
exactly.
It or sugarcoat it.
They're not trying to cover it up.
Right.
Nope.
Yeah, I like that approach. What do you think, a business communications professor Heather Harris?
I agree with Sarah.
Yeah.
Even beyond the tourism, there's a push to attract people to come to live in Baltimore. So who are you going to attract? If you're not going to fix the schools up, if you're not going to deal with poverty, if you're not going to deal with jobs, who are you going to attract? Childless people who want to live downtown, who mm-hmm. can take part in the free bus while everybody else suffers waiting for a bus an hour, hour 15, maybe when it comes, not in service. Some areas have a bus stop every 50 yards. Other areas, you know, you have to walk half a mile to get a bus. we have to decide to look at everything holistically. We can't say this is about the black community. This is about Baltimore.
This is about people who live here.
It's about everybody.
The point was made on the show the other day that while tourism is important to the city, we really need to focus on the people who already live here. And attracting new residents is important. What about the people who live here? The point you just made about the bus, for instance. You know?
And, you know, injustice, it touches everyone. Discrimination touches everyone. And so we have to come to a decision. We have to come to a place where we say, okay, I'm not just going to deal with this problem that I think only touches African Americans. I'm not going to deal with this problem that only touches Latinos. I'm not going to deal with this problem that only touches LGBTQI. I'm going to deal with people. And I want the best for everyone. And that is an American problem. It is not a Baltimore problem.
Thank you, Heather. I just want to add Sherry Parks into our conversation. Sherry was on the show yesterday, midday contributor, associate dean in American Studies at the University of Maryland College Park, because there's something we didn't get to on the show yesterday that I thought was that related to what we're talking about in this hour about Baltimore life. Sherry, thanks again for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sherry wanted to talk about the arts community and how artists might respond to these events in Baltimore. Go right ahead, Sherry.
Well, I wanted to talk about how artists already are responding. I mean, we saw people on the ground actually taking some of the places of social agencies when the schools were closed. Muse 360, Jubilee Arts, were actually feeding people. And that makes the point that they're on the ground and they're positioned to do that. But we also learned about a week and a half ago, there was a conference here in Baltimore, that other cities, Philadelphia, New York, San Francisco, consider Baltimore to be ahead of them in using the arts for social change. And so the point we wanted to make, that a number of the arts organizations are trying to make, is that it's important for the city to use them in that way. There are a number of ways that the arts can be useful and are being useful. I mean, we're a city in need of healing right now, both healing spaces and healing people, and there are different ways in which people have been traumatized, but a lot of people have been traumatized, and it's pretty clear, there's very clear evidence that arts can be useful for that. Clearly, it can be used to bring people back in the city. After 9/11, the mayor at the time said, it is your patriotic duty as New Yorkers to come into the city, to either be in the city or come to the city to go to shows. And we have art institutions who may end up struggling because people from other counties won't come in. But the idea that Baltimore is being watched by the world has to be amended by that the arts world is watching to see what Baltimore does and how we use it. And there's a lot of intelligence, and I said this yesterday, on the ground in Baltimore. And part of that intelligence is the art and culture community. Last week, just by coincidence, we in this case, is the University of Maryland College of Arts and Humanities, had our third Thinkathon for Baltimore. And it is a meeting of the arts and culture community and the foundations and social activists and individual artists and who come together for a think and do session. And, of course, we oriented this toward the disturbances and came out with short-term and long-term action, because it's that type of day conference. And right now we're going through the notes and people are beginning to see what's already been done and what can be done. So it's beginning to circulate through the arts community.
It's great to hear that. And of course, you have North Avenue,
right?
The Arts District, Station North, right there on the edge of all this.
Right. And yeah. I mean, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
It's very sad that it had to happen, but as one Washington Post writer said, it couldn't have happened to a nicer place. And in this case, we're in position, we, the city, are in a position to do this right this time, to take the arts and culture community, use them for all their worth, I mean, because they're ready to go, and use it to heal communities and to build beyond, not to go back to the old status quo, but to build into something better.
All right. You heightened my interest in it. Thank you very much, Sherry.
Good.
Yeah, I'd like to see what comes of that in the months ahead.
Yeah, I think Sherry makes a wonderful point. Art is healing, and you know the artists also need to be part of that group along with the residents, because all of these voices will bring us to a very different solution than we have now. I remember driving up North Avenue to head home, and there was a street preacher on the corner of Pennsylvania and...
it's okay. There's a lot of corners there. Monroe?
Fulton, Monroe. By the CVS.
Yeah, Pennsylvania Avenue.
Thank you. Pennsylvania and North. And he said, you know, this is about one love, one Baltimore. And so the mayor now has this one Baltimore campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, she says there's no plan for it, right? There's no plan right now. So hopefully she's listening and she'll take into consideration that, you know, it takes more than the leaders that we deem the leaders, the legitimate leaders. There are leaders everywhere in every community. And all of those people, including the artists, the people living in the areas, the children, need to be brought to the table to hear, and not just to hear, but to have their solutions put into play. This is not something that we can solve from looking at it from the perspective of riots and what do we do next, because that would provide us with fair-based solutions. This is something that needs to be solved from the protest perspective, because the protesters were looking for justice, and that message is continually lost in the focus on the rioting. The protesters want justice. Everyone wants justice. Everyone wants dignity. Everyone wants peace. And if we do it that way, perhaps, we can have people not being afraid to drive in from Annapolis to have dinner downtown.
Thank you, Heather. Back to the phone lines for more comments from our listeners. Let's go to Pat in Baltimore. Pat, thanks for calling.
Hi, Dan.
Hi.
I'm in Baltimore County, and... well, there were a number of things I wanted to say, but to start, I just want you to know that I'm in my mid-70s, as are most of my friends, many of us widows. We're coming in tonight, as we always do, to hear the symphony. We're having dinner at Sammy's. We go to Everyman and Center Stage, usually in the evenings, and we didn't think twice about continuing to do that, and I would urge my fellow Baltimoreans to come in to the city this weekend and eat at a restaurant, have a drink, do something. There's so many ways that people can be involved. I worked for many years at Paul's Place. They would welcome anyone to come in, help a child with their reading or mentoring them. There are dozens of organizations like that, and so many chances to get to know people that you might not know otherwise. I found it richly rewarding. I loved it. We have so much more in common than we do than differences, and that's what you discover when you're in there and volunteering and enjoying the people that you meet.
Thank you for saying all that, Pat. I'll just throw in something else. If you're looking this weekend to have a different experience, maybe you haven't been to the corner of Pennsylvania Avenue and Pressman Street, known as Resurrection Intersection. That's where a big block party is being held by the No Boundaries Coalition. They're putting it on, along with the Jubilee Arts folks that Sherry just mentioned here. So you can do that. That's tomorrow. Is tomorrow May 9th? Yeah, May 9th, between 1 and 4 p.m. at Pennsylvania and Pressman Streets. If you want to get over there in that West Baltimore and meet some really nice people what's become a beautiful corner in Baltimore City. Just take another call. Sonia in Gwin Oak. Sonia, you're on Midday. Hi.
My comment is, you were asking before about how you may have been affected. I live in Baltimore County as well. I'm African-American, and my son is African-American. And I hope that this is about healing. I personally have experienced discrimination with the police. I felt we have so many issues here in Baltimore and the surrounding areas. I started at the age, probably about the age of 10, telling my son, giving him instructions on what to do if he stopped by a police officer. And intermittently throughout his teenage years, I continued to do that. As a driver, he's now a driver, I purchased one of the blinder overhead that you can put on the blinder in front of you to keep the registration, as opposed to keeping the registration in the glove compartment.
You mean the visor in the car?
Right.
Oh, okay.
Visor in the car, it's... just a like a little sliding case.
So he can reach for it easily? Is that
Yeah, so he can reach for it easily if he's stopped by police.
How old is he now, Sonia?
Now he's 23.
How's he doing with all this? What have you talked about with your son?
Pretty much we talked about how, you know, it's the issue of Freddie Gray, how it seems like it's been that way for a very long time. I remember when I was a little girl, I went to school in Indianapolis, Indiana. We were told, we had the officers come in and say, and we were told, you know, if you're ever in trouble, if you ever need help, you know, go to a police officer because he'll be there to help you. And unfortunately, here, could not say that 100%, and I want to be able to do that. That's why I hope we're healing. I want to be able to tell anyone, not just my African American son, but anyone that you can trust an officer. So, you know.
And does he feel that way?
No.
He doesn't. He doesn't feel that way. Yeah, I'm not surprised to hear that. Well, we're trying to get in a couple more calls here. Fred in Baltimore on the same topic of police officers. Go right ahead, Fred.
Great. Thank you for having me. My issue is the whole complicitness of police officers. If you look at any police officer video where there's a brutality going on to a victim, why do other police officers just stand around? Because if you watch it, you see them just standing around allowing one officer to act badly. Why don't they step in and say, hey, this gone too far, you know, calm down, cool the situation? Why did it stand around and allow that to happen? And I think it's the complicitness that the citizens are upset about, that they never step in and say, hey, to a colleague, you're doing something wrong. I don't think there are many other professions where they would allow that to occur when another colleague is doing something inappropriately.
You know, that's sort of the nature of the charges against the six officers in the Freddie Gray case. They allowed this to happen. They didn't give him medical attention. And you read the charges as presented by the state's attorney, and you wonder, why didn't somebody say, wait a minute, what are we doing here?
Well, it might be part of the practice and the policy of the organization. Every organization has a culture, and people in those organizations, when they go against it. So if the other police officers were to say, stop, this is not right, that police officer or those police officers might be punished internally in that culture of that organization because of that, because there are rules that everyone follows regardless of where he or she works.
We've got time for one more call before our next break. Sarah, go right ahead. Could you please be brief?
Oh, hi. Am I on?
Yeah, just please be brief, Sarah. Go right ahead.
Yes, I'm calling from Remington. I've recently moved back to Baltimore. I'm from here after 10 years in New York. And it just seems to me, I wish we were talking about the red line a little more, about it seems like that would be a great way to solve some problems, to create jobs, to mobilize people, and also to get people of different classes commuting to and from work together as a way to bring people together naturally. It's one of the things that I love and miss from New York, and I hope that we can expand it in Baltimore.
You're right on. I mean, you mentioned it in the previous hour, but this is on the governor's table in Annapolis, and this could have a lot to do with efforts to create jobs and, you know, improve the quality of life in the west side of Baltimore and get some private investment going there, along with a big public investment in the Red Line. I thank Sarah Meehan from the Baltimore Business Journal for being here today. And Heather Harris, thank you again.
Thank you.
Great to have you here on the Midday Show. Please come back again. We have to take a break. And when Midday returns, in 1944, a 14-year-old African-American boy was convicted of murder of two white girls and executed. 70 years later, he was exonerated. After the break, we'll speak with a Peabody Conservatory grad student whose opera about the execution of George Stinney Jr. is set to make its world debut in Baltimore. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here. In 1944, a South Carolina jury took 10 minutes to decide that George Stinney Jr. was guilty of the rape and murder of two white girls, Betty June Binnaker, age 11, and Mary Emma Thames, age 8, Thames. George Stinney Jr., just 14 years old, was executed in the electric chair. He was the youngest person to be put to death in the United States in either the 20th or in this century. 70 years later, civil rights activists, long troubled by this case, worked to bring justice to George Stinney's family. Last December, a judge vacated George Stinney's conviction, acknowledging that his constitutional rights had been violated. There was no evidence linking him to the crimes. He had been questioned without a lawyer or his parents present, and his confession was likely coerced by police. Next weekend here in Baltimore, an opera about the conviction and execution of George Stinney will make its world premiere. We're going to tell you about that. And right now we meet the creator and composer of this opera, Francis Pollock, who is a graduate student at the Peabody Conservatory here in Baltimore, seeking her master's in vocal performance. Nice to have you with us, Francis.
Thank you for having me.
And Tariq Al-Sabir is with us, a senior at Peabody, pursuing his undergraduate studies in voice. He plays George Stinney Sr. in the opera. Tariq, nice to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thanks.
And Tariq, you grew up in Baltimore, is that right?
I did.
Yeah, nice to have you in the studio. Okay. So, Francis Pollock, first of all, how did I do in pronouncing the name of Emma Thames or Thames?
Thames. Mary Emma Thames.
So these two girls, Betty June Binnaker and Mary Emma Thames. And this was where in South Carolina? What was the town?
This is Alkaloo, South Carolina. And so it's about an hour and a half outside of Charleston.
How did you get interested in this case? I remember hearing about George Stinney's exoneration or reading the news about it only this past December.
Mm-hmm.
But you've been on this case longer than that.
I have. So about December 2013, I came across... This is a very uninspiring story, but I came across a Upworthy article about the youngest person to be executed in the United States, and saw that it was a young boy named George Stinney who had been accused of the rape and murder of two girls. And what was really interesting to me about this case was that he was from the same region of the country that I'm from. I'm from North Carolina. I went to undergraduate in I did my undergraduate at Furman University in South Carolina, and George lived and died 2 hours away from, you know, where I did my undergraduate degree. And so I became, you know, instantly attracted to this case, and kind of saw the correlation of George Stinney was an African-American boy. He was accused of raping and murdering two white girls. And I understood, like, kind of the culture that he lived in.
As a graduate student, do you have to undertake writing a full opera, or did you just read this story and say, I'm going to push, I'm going to write an opera based on this?
Well, it's really interesting because I'm actually not a composition master student.
No, you're a voice.
Voice, so I'm supposed to be singing opera, not writing opera.
Right. That is a little unusual.
This was a story that I felt, like, instantly compelled. I was like, I have to tell this. Like, I can tell this. It's a great story. It's about someone that I would know. And, like, I have to say this, especially growing up in a South that's still very segregated in many ways.
And how would you describe the music that you've composed for this?
Somewhat unoperatic. It is full of jazz and blues and gospel and Baptist hymns and folk songs.
And how long had you worked on it before you felt like it's ready to be staged?
It has been a very quick process. I started writing it in May of last year, and it's going up next weekend, so about a year.
Just for a moment there, would you tell us about the space where you're going to be performing this?
Sure. It's going to be premiered at 2640 Space.
That's
which
on St. Paul Street?
It is, yeah. It's a church. St. John's.
That's Old St. John's. It's a nice concert space. So you're using that for the opera.
I am, yeah. It's going to be beautiful. I mean, I don't think there's anything more appropriate to do a opera about the South in a renovated church.
Now, Tariq Al-Sabir plays the father of George Stinney.
Mm-hmm.
And Tariq, had you ever heard of this case before Francis wrote this opera?
I think I knew about it just like kind of vaguely, that I knew that the youngest guy to be executed was a young black guy.
And 14 years old, I mean, when you think about that, that was the age of criminal responsibility at the time in South Carolina. And now, of course, we've had Supreme Court decisions about the treatment of minors by the criminal justice system, especially when it comes to punishment, sentences, and the death penalty. So When you were first recruited to do this, or you auditioned for it, what did you think of it, and what do you think of it?
Oh, I thought it was
Francis's work.
Well, Francis is a good friend of mine, so that's a plus there. But also, I thought it was an extremely noble cause to be wanting to actually focus on this and do a work on it. And so, as I was already about it, because I do a lot of work in my art with just like social justice kind of stuff, and I'm from Baltimore, and here in Baltimore, I'm very active in that kind of stuff. So I was like, I'm all about it, and it's a new work, and I love singing new stuff. So I was really excited to do it. But as things have been going on, and we have George Stinney, who got exonerated while we were already preparing for the piece, and then, you know, more kind of social justice concerns and issues rose up in Baltimore.
Yeah.
I think I'm even more and more inspired and fired up to do this now.
Can we listen to a little bit here? This is a scene that you're in.
Awesome.
And this is a scene with you with your wife, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we just listen to a little bit, and then you can tell us what's going on here.
Sure.
This fear, this hate, is bigger than us, Alma. It's bigger than George, bigger than Alkaloo, bigger than black and white. They look at us and sees a people capable of killing little girls. And they're ready to kill us because they're so scared.
This is a scene with your wife.
Mm-hmm. So here, this is the scene right after our house just kind of got bombarded by some official police and some not so official police. Came to our house, told me what they thought about whatever happened, and they took George. And they're just telling us that like they're threatening us, things like that. And so George Cindy Sr. is here trying to keep his wife calm, keep things realistic, while knowing, I think deep down, that George is probably going to be either legally or illegally killed.
Francis, you have a unique way of telling this story. The story is told through the two victims, am I right?
It is. It was really important to me when writing this opera to, you know, talk about the true tragedy of the story as a collective. You know, I mean, obviously, the execution of a 14-year-old African-American boy is horrible. It's horrific. But we can't forget that, you know, two other children died in the story, and that provides the catalyst for everything that happened, for the fear that pervaded Alkaloo and this community. Like, it happened because two children died.
Right.
And so it was really important to me to tell the story and include them. But it's also really important for me to tell the story through their eyes. One, because that's the only perspective that I understand about the South, is growing up as a young white girl. And so, like, you know, we're talking about all of these social issues and all of these issues with race and with injustice. But I wanted to tell them as I grew up seeing them.
If people want to see your opera,
mm-hmm.
there are still tickets available?
There are. They're going very, very quickly.
Okay. So the performances are next weekend.
Mm-hmm.
May 15th and 16th, am
mm-hmm.
I right?
Mm-hmm.
And what time are those performances?
There's a pre-concert talk at 7 o'clock, and then the show starts at 7:30.
Okay, very good. And again, this is at 2640 St. Paul Street,
mm-hmm.
the 2640 space.
Mm-hmm.
This is the opera is simply called Stinney, based on the true story of George Stinney Jr., who was executed at the age of 14. We've been speaking with Francis Pollock, of the Peabody Conservatory, graduate student there in voice, who has composed this opera. So congratulations to you on getting this done. And Tyreek El-Sabir, Baltimore native, performing in his own Baltimore here next weekend in this opera as George Stinney Sr. It was nice to meet you, Tyreek.
Thank you.
Yeah, good luck to you.
Absolutely.
Break a leg, I'd say.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Francis. And thank you for coming in to talk to us. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to Midday all this week. I hope you have a pleasant weekend, and we'll see you again on Monday.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Aaron Morenzi, Alexis Kuhn, and Aaliyah Satterfield. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.